From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are watching Hurricane Florence, which made landfall earlier today near Wrightsville Beach, North Carolina, with winds up to 90 miles per hour. And while many people have evacuated the coastline along the Carolinas, some have stayed behind, including Mastin Kluwer, who owns a boat in South Carolina. Mastin, tell me where you are right now.
I'm sitting on the boat right now as we speak.
On the boat in Little River, South Carolina, which is very close to Myrtle Beach and not that far off of the shore of the Atlantic Ocean.
Yes, sir. I believe I'm about 2 miles away on the intercoastal.
What is it like right now?
It is pouring the rain and the wind is whipping.
And why did you decide to stay on a boat when everybody has been telling everyone else to get out of harm's way?
Well, I come down here to secure my boat and make sure, you know, it's tied as good as it could be and just keep an eye on things for me and the rest of the people down here, as we all would do for each other if we were down here.
Are there a lot of other people there?
Actually, no. I thought there'd be more, but I don't see anybody. We haven't lost power yet, but I hadn't seen a soul.
You haven't lost power?
Not yet, no, sir.
Are you worried about the danger of being there?
I guess I'm a little nervous. I'm waiting on the storm surge. It's a big threat right now, I think.
So the storm surge hasn't hit where you are yet?
Not as of yet, no. Not as I can tell, no. Everything seems normal on the tides and the water, and I think it's yet to come from what they say.
So what's so special about this boat that you had to go and protect it?
Nothing really special other than it's mine. I didn't see nothing happen to it.
So did any of your friends or family members try to convince you not to go down there to the boat?
All of them. All of them.
And what'd you say?
I was going regardless, so... Yeah, they all want me to stay at home, but I thought I'd better come right here and check on things. So.
Have you been through a hurricane before?
No, sir, not like this. I live about 4.5 hours from the coast, and we're going to get a lot of rain where I live, back in North Carolina. But and we, of course, lived through Hugo years ago, but yeah, nothing like being down here when it hits.
But you say so far the worst is the rain right now.
Yes, sir. I mean, it's been windy. I stayed up to about 5 a.m., and it was kind of weird. It'd be quiet for a second, and then it sounded like a Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds were coming over. You could hear the wind just whistling in the distance, and it would hit. I'd never heard anything like that. I mean, you could hear it coming, and then it hit. But so far, everything's tied up, and everything's good.
Well, I hope it stays that way, Mastin. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Mastin Kluwer there speaking to us from his boat in Little River, South Carolina.
Brave guy there. So let's move up the coast now. NPR's Brackton Booker is in New Bern, North Carolina. That's about 90 miles northeast of Wilmington. Brackton, be our eyes for us. What are you seeing?
Well, thanks, Peter. We're seeing lots and lots of water on the ground where it's not normally. On the way from Greenville, North Carolina, where we were based last night, riding out the beginning of the storm, we drove down Highway 43 to New Bern, where there have been reports of widespread flooding. And the roads were pretty good on the way from Greenville. And as soon as we got to the city limits of New Bern, that's when we started to see real evidence of flooding. And let me tell you right now, the rain is starting to come down really, really hard, and it's a piercing rain. It's coming down sideways. And when it's hitting your body, it really feels like it's a sharp pin in you.
We're also hearing reports today of a lot of people trapped in the town where you are this morning. The mayor, Dana Outlaw, told NBC that emergency crews are trying to get people who are stuck in their cars or in their homes, in their attics, trying to get them to safety.
Just be patient. We're on the way. We will get you rescued, all 150. But just bear with us because we have to be so careful that our first responders are not put in harm's way in this type of weather.
So, Brackton, up to 150 people as of this morning trapped. What are the rescuers doing to get people to safety?
Well, I am talking to you from the New Bern Fire Station headquarters. And from here, there are like 4 or 5 fire trucks. And you see volunteers coming up with their boats asking where they can help. Now, as as we were coming into New Bern, the overpass, some of the lower lane roads were already covered with water. You could see like a riverboat that was up against a railroad track. And so people are finding out on Facebook that, hey, people really, really need some help here. And so they're coming down to the fire department, and the fire department is directing them to other areas where they're getting in these skiffs and going to get people and try to cut out some of the roofs in some cases to get people out.
Wow.
And what I've been told is that these little skiffs are rescuing people off their homes, bringing them to slightly bigger boats and transferring the people and then taking them to dry land.
I spoke with an official from Duke Energy yesterday, and he told me that the utility was expecting between 1 and 3 million people in the region, including North and South Carolina, would be or could be without power. What kind of outages are you hearing about? I know you haven't been on the ground that long, but what information do you have about that?
Yeah, so as of last check, the North Carolina Emergency Management Office said that about 500,000 people just in North Carolina alone are without power. And as you hear in the background, a fire engine is just getting revved up and is about to go out on a call. And a little bit about that, they are telling me here that it's not just the water, and it's not just the flooding. They are also getting calls about fires in people's homes because they're running generators, and they're also telling us about gas leaks in people's homes. So, like, the first responders are having triple duty as Florence packs its punch coming across here.
Okay. NPR's Bracton Booker in New Bern, North Carolina, at a fire station there. Bracton, be safe. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
Well, and speaking of gas leaks and fires, let's get to the story out of Massachusetts. A series of gas explosions that ignited at least 60 fires in Lawrence, Andover, and North Andover, Massachusetts yesterday afternoon. An 18-year-old man was killed in Lawrence and at least 20 others injured. Thousands forced to evacuate their homes. Nancy Fernandez says she had to walk from the town of Reading to get her family last night before heading to a shelter in Lawrence. That's at least a 10-mile walk because transportation in the area was at a standstill.
I'm exhausted. My legs hurt. My blood pressure's high. My kids are uncomfortable. My grandkids. And I still have my other kids in there, but I need to show up to work.
Joining us now is WBUR reporter Callum Borchers, who is in Lawrence. Callum, Columbia Gas had announced on Thursday before this happened that it was doing work to the gas lines in these towns. What do we know about what caused this?
Well, that would seem to be the most obvious explanation, but Columbia has not said explicitly that that gas work is what caused the explosions and still is not answering those questions. I was in North Andover a little bit earlier this morning where Columbia sent a couple of representatives to answer customers' questions in a sort of impromptu gaggle on Main Street, but they didn't really have many answers, Jeremy. They basically just jotted things down on a clipboard and said, we'll get back to you later.
Tell us about the extent of the damage. We saw images yesterday of homes on fire.
Yeah, so the state police so far have confirmed 70 incidents of fires or explosions at homes. And, of course, there are many other incidents in which folks are smelling the odor of natural gas. Folks have been asked to evacuate their homes. Many are still at shelters right now. And it's not clear what the timetable is for when they'll be able to get back into their homes.
You spoke to Michael Forresta, who's an attorney in North Andover today. Here's what he said.
I mean, I understand that they're dealing with an emergency. However, for hours and hours and hours, the residents, business owners, and visitors to these three communities were completely in the dark about what was even going on.
How are people feeling today about how this emergency was handled?
Really frustrated, Jeremy. I mean, this gaggle that I was at this morning in North Andover really sort of devolved into an ugly scene where you had people shouting questions at company representatives who seemed totally overwhelmed. They sort of walked away, turned their backs on the crowd, kind of tried to regroup, came back, fielded a few more questions, jotted down a few more notes, and then left as people continued to shout questions and really just sort of vent their frustration at the way the company was not giving them a whole lot of information.
Are people allowed to return to their homes at this point?
No, not yet. So what the customers were told this morning was that Columbia is going to go door to door to each of the 8,000 some odd homes affected in this area, and they're going to shut off the gas mains there, and they are going to do safety inspections and then one by one notify folks that they are allowed to go back to their homes, or in some cases they might say this street is reopened and you're allowed to go back there. But there is a lot of uncertainty right now about when folks can get back in, and the answer right now is no.
And what about restoring power and gas service? to some 18,000 homes and buildings that where it was shut down.
Well, so it's sort of mixed. So along Main Street in North Andover right now, you've got power at some of the businesses on one side of the street, and then others are out. So some of them are running generators. They do have power, and they're not really sure what they should do. I spoke with some business owners who were like, you know, should I open today? They can't tell whether it's worthwhile, whether anybody will even come in. It looks like kind of a ghost town right now. It's a bit eerie.
That is Callum Borchers, a reporter with WBUR, joining us from Lawrence, Massachusetts. Callum, thank you.
Glad to be with you.
President Trump is at the White House today receiving updates on Hurricane Florence. As the storm raged this morning, he tweeted that FEMA, first responders, and law enforcement were doing an incredible job. Yesterday, Trump was widely criticized for his tweet rejecting the official death toll from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico last year. He accused Democrats of trying to make him look bad.
In other news out of Washington today, as part of a plea deal reached today, former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort has agreed to cooperate with FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller as Mueller investigates possible Trump campaign collusion with Russians. Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable, Tolu Olorunipa, Bloomberg News White House reporter. Hi, Tolu.
Hi there.
And Beth Fooey is NBC Senior Politics Editor. Hi, Beth.
Hey there.
So let's start with this news about Paul Manafort. What does this mean, Beth, that he's going to cooperate after all this time?
Yeah, it's extraordinary on so many levels. I mean, we know that just weeks ago, Trump was touting the fact that Manafort was standing strong and wasn't going to cooperate. He seemed to disparage his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, because Michael Cohen did decide to cooperate. So this is a major, major setback from that standpoint. Trump's campaign manager, the man who was in charge of his campaign for so many months, was at the same time engaged in criminal activity, according to this this cooperation agreement and this plea that we are learning about today. So even though the White House has put out a couple of statements, one from Sarah Sanders, one from the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, saying this has nothing to do with the president or with his campaign, that's clearly not the case.
Tolu, this is fascinating because he has said he is going to now cooperate with the Mueller investigation. What sort of information might he bring to that?
Well, Paul Manafort was the campaign manager for President Donald Trump's campaign as it was leading up to the convention during the summer and pretty crucial months. And he was part of the campaign for a good chunk of it. This is someone who knows about the policy process within the Trump campaign, who knows about the people who are coming in and out, and has spent a lot of time with the president himself. So he could provide information that Robert Mueller might not be able to get on his own about the conversations that were taking place during the time that the Russians were involved in trying to interfere in the election. You have to remember that right before the Democratic convention, at the time when Paul Manafort was still the campaign manager, the federal government says the Russians hacked into emails that were DNC emails and released those emails to the public and really disrupted the DNC, or sorry, the Democratic convention, and led to the ousting of the DNC chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So whether or not the Trump campaign was aware of any of this, you have to remember that the meeting with Don Jr., which happened in 2016, with several Russians who promised dirt on Hillary Clinton, happened at the time when Paul Manafort was the campaign manager, and he was in on that meeting. He might be able to provide more information about whether or not President Trump knew about that meeting, or whether or not that meeting led to any other information. So there are key questions that have not yet been answered that Paul Manafort might have answers to.
So as all this is going on, there's a Supreme Court nomination hanging in the balance. President Trump has the opportunity to put somebody on the court for life. And now we're getting word from The New Yorker. They're reporting today about an accusation of sexual misconduct against the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh from when he was in high school more than 30 years ago. A woman claims Kavanaugh and a classmate were drunk at a party when they held her down, turned up music, and Kavanaugh covered her mouth as he tried to force himself on her. Kavanaugh is denying this allegation. But how serious is this, Beth, for the Kavanaugh nomination? Or is he in any trouble at all? Or will he just be confirmed just as many thought he would be a week ago?
Well, it calls to mind the confirmation of Clarence Thomas all those many, many years ago, about 20 years ago. 7 years ago that justice was confirmed amid sexual harassment and assault allegations. And of course, the accuser did come forward. Anita Hill did come forward in this case with Judge Kavanaugh. We don't know the identity of the woman or whether she will step forward and if that would change anything. But we're in a very different environment than we were back in those days. As you recall, 11 Democrats voted for Clarence Thomas to become a Supreme Court justice, even after Anita Hill stepped forward. We're in a much more partisan environment right now, and Republicans seem really hell-bent on getting this confirmation through and getting Judge Kavanaugh onto the court and onto the bench in time for the beginning of the court session in October. It's unclear to me whether anything can prevent that, short of this accuser stepping forward and making a credible case, and she may not be willing to do that. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, as a very interesting development on this case today, Senator Grassley, who heads the Judiciary Committee, has a letter now from 65 women who apparently knew Kavanaugh as a young man or as in high school, testifying to his respect for women and how well he treated women in those days. So it looks pretty clear that the Republicans on the committee were aware that this accusation was out there and were prepared for it.
Well, and there are also some Democrats that might vote for Kavanaugh. We were speaking on the show this week with Senator Donnelly of Indiana, who's up for re-election. He hasn't said which way he's going to go on this. And he's having to be very careful about, you know, saying, I support Trump when I agree with him and I don't when I don't. Here he is talking with us.
When President Trump is right, I'm with him. I voted with him 62% of the time. When he's not, you know, I try to let him know here's an alternate plan. Here's a better way to do something.
Tolu, when you hear him say that, do you think he or other Democrats might actually vote for Kavanaugh?
Yeah, they're facing a lot of pressure from Democrats within their states to vote against Kavanaugh. But at the same time, these are states that voted, in many cases, overwhelmingly for President Trump. And they're also facing pressure from Republicans whose votes they need to vote for Brett Kavanaugh and to confirm him to the Supreme Court. So they are in a pretty tough position heading into probably some of the toughest midterm races of their lives at a time when President Trump is out on the campaign trail, reminding his own voters that these Democrats are not reliable votes for his agenda. And the Supreme Court is one of the top issues that voters care about when they are looking at who to put into the Senate. So they are in a tough spot. And these new revelations, new accusations against Brett Kavanaugh may give them some pause to potentially vote for him. But no matter what they decide, they're going to face backlash either from the Democratic base or the Republican base and Republican moderates who they need in order to secure their reelections.
Beth, speaking of those midterms, what do you make of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell? We covered this on the program earlier in the week, saying that Senate races in 9 states are going to be very challenging for Republicans, including states that really weren't on the radar just a couple of weeks ago. McConnell said it's going to be like a knife fight in an alley. What do you think changed, or did anything change?
Oh, yeah, something definitely changed. The president's approval rating has dropped precipitously in the last month or so. Numerous polls have picked that up, and we don't know precisely why. I mean, one could hazard a guess. I mean, whether it's because of the meeting with Putin, where he seemed to side President Trump seemed to side with Putin over the intelligence community on issues of whether his campaign had or whether Russia had meddled in the election, whether it had something to do with just kind of the general ongoing chaos out of the White House, the Bob Woodward book, the Omarosa book, so many things have happened in the last month.
Right, yeah.
And so the president's approval rating has now dropped. Most new polls are showing it kind of hovering around in the high 30s. That is a danger zone for anybody running for election or reelection in the president's party this year. So suddenly what was looked like a pretty comfortable Senate scenario for Republicans has now been put into some jeopardy. When the president's approval rating goes down that low, there is no way that it doesn't affect others who are running on that party's ticket.
Okay, a good point. But listen to this. This is somebody that we spoke with in the Midwest this week. This is Brian Bossom. Now, he was laid off from the company Rexnord in Indiana. This is a company that President Trump called out for moving workers to Mexico. This guy was laid off. He voted for Obama twice. Then he voted for Trump. And here he is.
He was the only one that was talking about bringing jobs back to America. And I'll tell you the same thing I've told several that, you know, you ask me today, do you support President Trump? Absolutely. But ask me again tomorrow.
Tolu, what do you make of something like that? That voice, that view?
Yeah, there are a number of people who are trying to make that decision, whether or not to stick with President Trump despite all of the chaos in the White House, all of the negative headlines about what's happening within the White House, because the economy is great, because there's a potential that maybe they received, they saw their job come back after some, you know, manufacturing losses in the past. We're starting to see a resurgence in the manufacturing industry. Blue-collar jobs are back. So people are sort of trying to decide in some cases between their pocketbooks and their hearts, because they do realize that a lot of the chaos coming out of the White House is not necessarily good for democracy, but the economy is great, and you're seeing a lot of people trying to decide whether or not to stick with President Trump and vote for Republicans once again, or this new resistance, and we're seeing numbers of Democrats who are upset with what's happening within the White House turning out in record numbers in some cases, whether or not that will be enough to turn the tide during these midterms.
Okay, real quick. This is a day when we are all thinking about Hurricane Florence, but it's also a day when we're thinking about the president's reaction to his White House response to Hurricane Maria. He's rejecting the death toll. Nearly 3,000 people died. The president says, no, they didn't. Beth, just thoughts on that. Why is the president doing this?
He seems to obsess about certain things just constantly. We know he obsesses about his electoral vote margin. We know he obsesses about Hillary Clinton. He seems to be also obsessing about Hurricane Maria. This is something that's come up with him numerous times over the past year since that hurricane. It also shows a president who is inclined to believe conspiracy theories. And he is believing this theory that Democrats are trying to make the Hurricane Maria situation in Puerto Rico worse than it was, just to make him look bad. This is very consistent with how we've heard and him talk for all these many months.
But those numbers, they came from a study from George Washington University, not from Democrats. Right. Beth Fuhi and Tolu Onarunipa, thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
More than 1,500 mourners attended the funeral for Botham Jean in Richardson, Texas yesterday. Jean is the 26-year-old black man who was shot and killed in his own apartment by a white Dallas police officer a week ago. Christopher Connolly from member station KERA was at the service.
It was a ceremony filled with music, which was fitting because Botham Jean was known by friends and family for expressing his faith through song. Michael Griffin opened the service by telling the crowd that this was to be a celebration.
Today we're going to celebrate his life, celebrate the fact that God gave the world this young, energetic, smart, educated, talented young man of God.
Speaker after speaker told stories of Jean's kindness, his commitment to service, his profound spirituality. Alexis Stossel was a college friend.
A friend is the family that you choose. And let me tell you, Botham chose everyone.
Botham Shemjan grew up in the Caribbean nation of St. Lucia. He studied accounting in Arkansas before moving to Dallas to launch his career at PricewaterhouseCoopers. His uncle, Ignatius Jean, said the gunshot that killed his nephew rocked the small island nation where his family still lives.
Its impact was of nuclear proportions. A nuke had been unleashed on our family by someone charged to protect and serve.
Jean was fatally shot by Dallas police officer Amber Geiger last week. She lived in the same building. She told investigators that she had mistaken Jean's apartment for her own and shot him, thinking he was a burglar. Jean's family doesn't believe Geiger's story. At a news conference following the funeral, the family stood with about two dozen African-American church leaders. Sammy Berry is the lead minister at Dallas West Church of Christ, John's home church, for the last 2 years.
We will not stand by quietly as what we believe to be false narratives that diminish any culpability for the offending officer are advanced. The undeniable reality is that he was slain in his home, where he had the right to be and was abiding by the law.
Berry said Geiger should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law and asked that any protests remain nonviolent. That, he said, would honor the memory of Botham Jean. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
And one of the narratives that Minister Berry is referring to is that police say they found 10 grams of marijuana in Jean's apartment. That's less than half an ounce. Ben Crump, an attorney for his family, says it's an attempt to assassinate the character of a wonderful young man.
It's the same old playbook, assassinate the character after they assassinate his person.
Officer Amber Geiger is set to go before a grand jury, which will decide if she should be charged with murder or manslaughter.
The Emmy Awards are Monday night. HBO's Westworld has 21 nominations, including Outstanding Drama Series. The show is set sometime in the future at a theme park, which is staffed by human-like robots or hosts who exist for the humans or guests to enact their fantasies. But at the end of season one, the hosts rebel. Season two looks at the aftermath. In May, we spoke with the creators of Westworld, husband and wife, Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy. So I want to start with a big question first, which is in 2018, you know, artificial intelligence is moving right along. They're not as fancy as the robots in Westworld yet. But what do you think having this show be so popular right now means?
I think it speaks a little bit to the collective anxiety about what's happening with technology and humanity. We're in this kind of touch and go moment. And I think we're starting to feel a little more like we're losing control. And that's very much what the show's about.
You two both have some anxiety about artificial intelligence in real life.
Well, I don't let Alexa listen to my every move. We don't invite the computers into our home.
She says, while wearing an Apple Watch.
I know.
With an iPhone.
It's on airplane mode. I have to trust the airplane mode. Yeah, I mean, and we're not big on social media typically. So, yeah, I think we have a little bit of skepticism built in.
Do you think that AI will develop in the way that it does in Westworld, which is that the hosts, in your case, are indistinguishable from humans?
No, not at all. Westworld is a flight of fancy and a parable more than anything else. The way that this seems to be playing out is with conversational AI on one level. So you have your Siri or your Alexa. And then you're looking at networked intelligence. You're looking at a narrow AI that's sifting through the data. And you're looking at the kind of algorithmic intelligence that is so prominent in the news with regards to social media. We've looked at social media as kind of a dress rehearsal for AI. A dress rehearsal in the sense that we're looking at artificial intelligence and asking the question, will we build it responsibly? There's no government agency tasked with monitoring it or regulating it. And if social media is a dress rehearsal, then we've just failed badly. If things play out with AI the way that they have done with Facebook, we're in a lot of trouble.
Well, there's a storyline in this season of Westworld that has to do with the company taking a lot of the data from the humans who are going to visit the park. It sort of sounds very familiar with what we've just heard from Facebook and other tech companies.
Yes, it's been something that we've been thinking about for a long time, you know, and I think the greatest danger that AI poses isn't so much, you know, these anthropomorphic beings who look like us and are beguiling are going to fool us. It's the fact that a intelligence without a body or corporeal form will fool us into trusting it with data, which we seem to think is it has no repercussions. But the fact is a non-corporeal intelligence can do even more damage than one that is limited to a physical form.
You know, we'd be lucky if the problem was the problem that we're facing at Westworld.
That's scary.
You know, we're dealing with Evan Rachel Wood or Tandy Newton. We'd welcome those robot overlords. The ones we've gotten instead are your Facebook feed, and I think that's far more problematic.
I want to listen to a scene from the first episode of this season. This is a flashback where Jeffrey Wright, who plays one of the park's creators, is talking to one of the hosts, Dolores, played by Evan Rachel Wood.
You frighten me sometimes, Dolores.
Why on earth would you ever be frightened of me?
Not of who you are now, but you're growing, learning so quickly. I'm frightened of what you might become.
He says there, I'm frightened of what you might become. What are you saying about what the hosts are learning from the guests?
Well, the hosts have seen both the best and the worst of human nature. And, you know, in the first season, we've really focused on some of the negative behaviors on the guests. And so if we are like parents to the hosts, they certainly have learned some bad lessons. But it's also a general cautionary tale about hubris, the ways in which mankind tends to invent technologies because we have this drive to create and to innovate. And we don't necessarily pump the brakes when we're doing it. We think, well, if we created it, we'll always be able to control it. And I'm not sure that that is something that we should rely on.
We have to talk about violence on this show. There's a lot of violence in the first season, but in the first episode of this season, it sort of went to a new level. And I wonder whether you had any pause about that at all.
Without a doubt, the show is asking the question why we are drawn to entertainment that features violence. We abhor violence in the real world. But most of the entertainment that we watch, most of the video games that we play, are defined by violence. In the second season, one of the things that we wanted to challenge was the audience's sense of sympathy, having built through the first season, the audience's sympathy for the hosts. In the second season, now that the shoe's on the other foot, how far are we willing to go with them? And how far will we indulge their appetite for vengeance?
Jonathan Nolan, you wrote Memento. You co-wrote Interstellar, which are films that, like Westworld, play with time. Obviously, you have a strong interest in that.
Very much. Yeah. One of the things that we were most interested in with this project is perception and your understanding, a human understanding of reality. We know on some level that our understanding of reality is very limited. And when we were looking at this project, we were fascinated by the idea of, well, artificial intelligence wouldn't be limited in the same ways. They'd be limited in different ways. So the structure of the first season flowed from the fact that the hosts had perfect recall, but no mechanism for distinguishing between what was a memory and what was a present reality. And in the second season, we're playing with that more cards up.
Do the two of you ever get lost as you bounce around in time in these episodes, as you're putting them together?
We have a lot of charts. we have a lot of post-it notes all over the place. It kind of, if you look at our writer's room walls or our notebooks, it looks like somebody's having a bizarre breakdown in four different parallel planes. But somehow that helps us keep it together. We literally chart the storyline chronologically, and then we watch as those threads physically kind of wind around each other when we're laying them out.
Mm-hmm. I want to listen to another scene. This is Tandy Newton playing Maeve, who is a host who was a madam at the brothel. But as she became aware of what she was, she made her way out of the park and into the laboratory. And in this scene, she confronts a human who says that a host is just something they've programmed.
But what about me? My dreams. My thoughts. My body. Are they not real? And what if I took these unreal fingers? And use them to decorate the walls with your outsized personality. Would that be real?
So we've got Maeve and the other host that we heard earlier, Dolores, both strong women characters. I just wonder if there's anything about that. Did you try to lift up the women characters in this season of the show, especially given all of the Me Too movement that's going on right now?
It happened much more organically than that. By the time the Me Too movement started, we'd already finished writing all our scripts and were, you know, in the middle of production. That being said, the Me Too movement is a movement that feeds off of what has been happening in society. And neither Jonah nor I are blind to that, nor are we immune to that. And so, you know, when embarking upon this journey in terms of, okay, we have the chance to do a Western sci-fi creatively, what are the most exciting opportunities there? And the most exciting opportunities are often the terra incognita in terms of character. And for that, it's the women. You know, a lot of these movies, they really didn't dig that deep into the female characters. And so creatively speaking, you always want to try to say something new and explore people that you haven't seen before.
What is it like being the co-executive producers of this show and also being married?
Busy.
Do you ever not talk about work? I mean, what?
Well, we had two kids while we were making this show. So
one per season.
Yeah. So we have the work babies and we have the human babies. And when we're talking too much about work, the human babies complain loudly. And they are they're what I think keeps us sane and grounded while also somehow making our schedule more insane and less grounded.
So HBO has picked up the show for a third season. How long do you see this story playing out?
Depends on if you're asking in story terms or in chronological years.
I was just going to say
both.
That.
All the way to the bitter end.
That works on both levels.
That's Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, the co-creators and executive producers of the HBO show Westworld. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Our interview with Westworld creators Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy from last May. The show is up for 21 Emmys. Emmys coming Monday night.
For the next 4 days, a few lucky tourists will get a rare peek at one of America's most remote wilderness areas. Starting today, winners of the Denali National Park Road Lottery will be allowed to drive the 92-mile park road in their own car. Normally, you'd have to take a tour bus. Joining us now for more is Dan Ireland. He's a supervisory park ranger at Denali, and he's deep inside the park now. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. How you doing? Hi there. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and you are very, very far away in a very remote place. What are you seeing? If you were to step out your door right now, what would you see?
Well, the one side I can see beautiful fall colors. So I have willow brush and trees outside my window that are turned golden. The other direction is the Toklat River, and the mountains around there are also on just past the peak of autumn colors. But I am, yeah, as you said, deep inside the park, on a river surrounded by high tundra and occasionally wildlife.
So fall has already come to Alaska. Sell me on Denali National Park. What makes it so special?
Denali is a place you can come experience amazing mountain scenery, some of the kinds of experiences that we used to have all over the United States, all over North America, and there aren't as many places that are as protected as this place, and there aren't as many places that have the kind of just amazing mountain glacier-carved scenery as we have here. Of course, if you come to try to see wildlife, you have to see it on the wildlife's own terms. We don't have animals running around all the time, but people do have the opportunity to see big mammals, bears, moose, even wolves, dolls, sheep up on the hillsides, and then birds migrating from all over the world. There are just countless opportunities along that 92-mile road for people to either, if they choose to get out, to go for walks. What we don't have very many of is trails. People have typically are navigating wilderness on its own terms. You can travel along rivers on river gravel. You can walk out on open tundra. It's pretty fascinating experience to go out where you're not on a trail. You're not going where the trail leads you, but you have to make your own plan and your own route. It is possible to go climb small mountains around here and have incredible experiences.
Now, because it's so remote, it's hard to get to, but it's also hard to get into. We're reading that something like 10,000 people apply for these lottery permits every year, but you know, just a relative handful get them. What's the demand for the lottery, and what can you see if you get it that you wouldn't otherwise get to see?
The demand is, as you said, over 10,000. We think that there are over 11,000 people that applied this last May, and that is for 400 permits for each day. And I should point out, beyond the 4 days you mentioned, there's actually a fifth day in which we have distributed 400 permits to active duty military through the bases here in Alaska. We call it Military Appreciation Day. And so there's actually a fifth day where a lot of local active duty military and their family get to come out. They are driving out on their own. They can work on their own time frame, stopping as they want to enjoy the day, to stop for wildlife, to enjoy scenery, to go for walks and hikes while they're here. but there usually are well over 300, 350 vehicles each day traveling through the park.
A lot of parks in the national park system, I know we've reported on this, have problems with overcrowding. Is that why you started this lottery in Denali? Was it an issue of too many people on the road?
Indeed. And we were very lucky because way back in 1971, we saw that with the highway system now providing access, easier access from the cities in Alaska to Old Mount McKinley National Park, we started limiting vehicles way back then, starting in 1972. During the summer, you could only come into the park on buses. Through the late 1980s, though, if you were here in mid-September, you still had a few days you could travel. We limited that when we started seeing well over 1,000 or even 1,500 cars per day. And so we set up a lottery system in 1990 with the 400 vehicle per day limit.
The park is also known for its glaciers. We saw a report out this year that Mount Hunter, the glacier on Mount Hunter, is melting at a rate that is faster than it has in the past 400 years. Scientists say it's an issue of climate change. Have you noticed any major changes in the parks in the time that you've worked there that you might consider to be a part of a changing climate?
I myself have been here off and on for 20 years. I would say I haven't necessarily noticed major changes, but I have been privy to some more subtle changes. There are certain birds that we see more of that we didn't see this far north in the past. The American robin is one that comes to mind. As I understand it, they were here, but certainly not in the numbers that we now see them in the summer. We are definitely seeing retreat of glaciers on both the north and the south side of the Alaska Range, just as throughout Alaska and again throughout the world. We had always had the glaciers really retreating ever since the last ice age, so that's not necessarily having a major impact immediately. But our park researchers and scientists are closely monitoring changes in the vegetation, and I do notice more places that have spruce trees than we used to have before. Again, a big part of that park road has been above tree line, and it still is, but there isn't evidence that that's changing as well.
That's Dan Ireland, supervisory park ranger at Denali National Park and Preserve. The lottery permit system is in effect as of today. I wish I could be there. Dan, thanks very much for your time. It sounds like a beautiful place.
Thank you, and come on back when you can.
And Jeremy, the truth is, I won the lottery this year.
Oh, no.
I couldn't make it. It is so far away.
There's always next year.
There, hopefully. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Some people win the lottery twice. It's Here and Now.